Welcome to another episode of So That Happened. In today's episode, we're going to be starting a series of interviews with political candidates. Today, we talked to Dr. Mark Newman, who is running for the 3rd Congressional District against Ron Kind in the August 11th primary. I'm talking today with Dr. Mark Newman, who is running for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. He's a Democrat and is running against Ron Kind in the primary on August 11th. So, welcome to Dr. Newman today. Hello, Mark.
Well, hello, Steve. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me on your show.
So, tell me a little bit about yourself and why you're running for Congress.
Sure. I like to say that I married into Wisconsin. I grew up in southern Illinois. In a little town on the Mississippi River called Quincy. And I became enamored with the life of the Franciscans who were serving in our local church there. And I became a Franciscan and ended up spending some time working as a missionary doctor in Africa. When I came back to the United States in the 90s, I think I had given up my Albert Schweitzer hero idealism a little bit. It kind of got beat out of me, perhaps. And I settled down and found my wife-to-be and moved into Wisconsin. I like to say I married into Wisconsin. And then about 10 years ago, we moved from Madison to La Crosse, Wisconsin. I got to that magical sort of 65 retirement age, and I would have to claim that I'm a boomer of the boomer generation, but not a tired boomer. Although I spent the first third of my life preparing for a really fine career, and the second third, the middle third, executing it as best I could. But the time was right for me to hang up the stethoscope because it was quite strenuous to be up at all hours caring for very sick children, and I found a younger doctor to take over the task, but I wasn't ready to stop. And looking around, it was real important to me to do the best I can to leave the world a little better. And I've become concerned about our political circumstances. This wonderful experiment of democracy that our country's been trying to do for 250 years. And every age has its own challenges. And I just didn't want to be 10 years older someday, you know, like 77, and look back and say, gosh, I wish it was still better. And I didn't do what I could have done when I had the strength and ability to give of myself. So I'm running for Congress because I think that when we go to the polls, we should be able to make a choice. And it's nice when we go to a primary to have at least two candidates on the ballot. And I think I have some perspectives on opportunities for improving our governance that are a difference with our congressmen. So that's what I'm doing.
Okay. Well, so you state in your campaign literature that one of your primary concerns is health care. Could you tell me a little bit about your proposals for changing U.S. health care, and how do you distinguish yourself from your opponent in that regard?
Sure. I have obviously been a front seat watcher of how we're paying for our health care for decades. And many times the conversation would turn in the direction of, are we ever going to get universal health care? And for decades, I would always respond, yes, of course we will. And people would say, how can you be so sure? And I would say, well, because all other countries with, you know, advanced developed economies have solved this problem, and it's inevitable for us to do the same. But the history of our health care payment system is different than everyone else, and it's real hard for us to get to that point. I think that the way we pay for our healthcare right now, with its broken, patchwork, balkanized system of payment, really is cruel. And it leaves us in way bad circumstances that we don't have to be in. We do not have to have families going bankrupt for serious diagnosis. So I'm convinced that the way to solve this problem is to have a single payer system, one checkbook to pay the bills, and we would finance that checkbook by public funding. And currently, 2/3 of our healthcare costs are being paid for from a tax base. So it's not a long stretch to just make sure that public funding supplements or, you know, and fills the coffers so that we can pay out of one checkbook. Other countries have, you know, like our neighbors to the north, have a single payer system. It works very well. People are happy with it there. And I'm convinced that that's where we have to go. We have some legislation in the Congress, H.R. 1384. It's a very fine piece of legislation introduced by the Congresswoman from Seattle, Pramila Jayapal. And if I was elected, I would become a co-signer as soon as I was eligible to become one. Our congressman does not get on board with that piece of legislation. He continues to advocate for improvement of the Accountable Care Act, so-called Obamacare. And that was a step that was made to try to expand healthcare to everybody. It wasn't successful in achieving that goal. And at the same time, its biggest problem is it continues to allow for profiteering, unnecessary and really inefficient profiteering to go on with our system. Obamacare does not solve the problem of our increasing healthcare costs, and it doesn't expand universal care to everyone. So I'm in disagreement with our Congressman Kind that we need to go much, much further than what we've tried to do under President Obama with that legislation.
Okay. Could you discuss a little bit your concerns about the environment and how you'd like to see U.S. policy change along those lines? And I'd also like to remind anybody who's watching this on YouTube or on Facebook Live, if you have any questions for Dr. Newman, put them in the comments and I'll see if I can ask them. Anyway, the environment.
You know, not that long ago, I have a almost 14-year-old boy, and he asked me, Dad, why is it that your generation has messed things up so bad for us relative to the environmental and climate change emergency? And leaving it for us who follow you to have to fix it up. And I thought, boy, those little guys, they really get smart alecky. But he's right. You know, we have not taken seriously the changing in climate. It's really a climate emergency. And what we see today is just the beginning. Even if we can go to zero carbon emissions today, changes are on course that are going to continue to cause huge demographic changes, geopolitical stresses. People in regions of the world are going to have to move from where they're living as temperatures continue to rise. We know that the oceans are going to continue rising, and many people living on the shores of water are going to need to be displaced. All of these changes are going to happen. We can't just sit back and hope that they don't. They will happen, and so we should be proactive. And I believe on a federal level, our country should be on the vanguard. We should be a leader. We should take our role as the most prominent economy in the world to help all nations, all 195 of us, to make prospective arrangements and interventions to deal with what is coming. And it's not an issue of reversing it. It really is an issue of mitigating the effects. And if we don't do it, it's just going to be worse. And if we do it, we can at least feel like we're carrying our part of the load.
Okay. Could you please describe your take on the current condition of politics in the country and what you would like to see change there? I think particularly what I'm asking about is the level of divisiveness and just prickliness and how everything seems to be politicized right now.
Yeah, when you started that question, my mind went to exactly what you were saying, the divisiveness. And it's one of the reasons that in the intro, I explained that I felt like this is the most important thing I can do with my life, to enter into the political arena, into that shared space where we come together in our community to talk about our future and how we want to govern ourselves, that political endeavor. Because I'm not an us against them kind of person. It's a kind of approach to life that it just doesn't resonate for me. I feel like a lot of times we are so busy drawing lines and leaving ourselves just one or the other option when most of life is very colorful and there are no binary decisions a lot of time, most of the time, actually. We need to be able to engage in comfortable and appreciating conversation to diagnose. Here I am as a doctor, diagnose our circumstances and to search for good solutions. I have a big sign that I carry sometimes or put up sometimes, and it says, democracy equals neighbors caring for neighbors. And I think that sums it up for me. That's the solution I wish to offer for our democratic self-governance of the people, by the people, and for the people to thrive. We need to be able to regard ourselves as neighbors, to have that respect for one another, to recognize each of ourselves as human beings and with all that that entails, and then to care for one another. And if we care for one another, and if we see all of our neighbors and see everyone in our communities as participant in that expanded neighborhood, then we can make democracy thrive and make it healthy.
I know from your campaign literature, you have some concerns about the military and the U.S. use of the military force. So could you tell me a little bit about your views on that?
For sure. You know, I'm actually connecting it in my own reflection with what our country is experiencing and actually humanity around the world to some degree as we're reflecting upon that horrible vision or that view of George Floyd being killed. I think that was a trigger that's hopefully opened up the opportunity for some hopefully fundamental change. But in my own reflection, I see that we use force sometimes to try to control other people's behavior. And on the international plane, we use our Pentagon military to attempt to control other people's behavior when somebody's making a determination that American interests are at risk. And unfortunately, a lot of the times that determination is based not upon physical threat to our homeland, but rather because somebody's saying that we can make better profits if we could have unlimited access to certain resources, and we judge that as a risk to our American security. And so we end up using our military not as a force of defense, but actually as a force of oppression. That's a strong comment, but I believe it. And I see the similar thing in our homeland when we take the resource of community policing with all of its possibilities of promoting safety and goodness within our communities, when it sometimes unfortunately gets used because of our fear that we as individuals feel to other people who have maybe a different ethnic heritage. And so one part of our community feels fearful to another, and then we have an opportunity perhaps to rely upon a police force, unfortunately, not necessarily intentionally, but a lot of times this is just the so-called institutional or bias that's just ingrained in our history. And this oppression is unfortunate, it's wrong. And so what we really need to do is to correct our militarized community policing, and we need to correct our politicized, I just made up that word, our politicized Pentagon military's operation in the world.
So that sort of rolls into what my next question was. And so other than demilitarizing our police forces in the country, do you have any particular distinct plans for changing policing, particularly when it comes to people of color?
You know, there's a lot of conversation about defunding the community policing. And, you know, that is a very rich conversation because, first of all, even the term means different things to different people. My personal belief is that we have all kinds of resources in our communities for helping us to build places to live and places to raise our children that are thriving places, places where human life is allowed to flourish and encouraged and expanded. And so what we need to do is to use those resources. I'm thinking about, you know, clinical social workers and social workers and other resources, you know, teachers and counselors, people who want to do excellent work, but their resources are, you know, experienced as being too limited. So I think it is a real question of placing our communal resources in the place where we can get the best advantage in order to achieve what I just described. And that is communities where we promote the thriving and the flourishing of all human life. To the degree that it's necessary, when people insist upon a violent action, we do need people who can deal with that. But most of, or I don't know, a lot, certainly a great deal of what our community police are called upon today is, you know, not something that a person with that type of force, you know, the force of guns or other instruments is not the best solution for a lot of the things that call them to responsiveness.
So speaking of guns, you had made some mention about issues with guns and the huge number of guns in the United States. Mm-hmm. And how often they are used for one reason or another. Do you have any comments about that?
Our country.
I thought you would.
Yeah, our country, you know, our country has for centuries had a story about itself that includes the presence of firearms. And our Constitution, the amendments, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution include a protection for the ownership of guns that has, by current Supreme Court jurisdiction, been reinforced and confirmed. That all being said, the real issue for us is not the presence of guns per se, but it's the firearm violence that places individuals at risk. And so anybody who is using their right to do something, it's never limitless. It's always controlled by other people. It's in tension with other people's rights. So the people who live in a community where there's the presence of a lot of firearms do not want to have to worry about their children being, or themselves being, injured because of some mistake, craziness, or whatever. So it is really necessary to establish the patterns of behavior, the regulation of our life together to manage firearm violence, which is a public health risk. And that could entail things like, well, certainly background checks and magazine size limitations. I think the red flag law legislation is a really fine way to help families deal with their worries when somebody in their home perhaps needs help and they have the presence of lethal force at their disposition immediately. These are all good ideas, and we need to use them as a way to manage the risk of our heritage of keeping firearms and guns in our presence.
Okay, let's move on to the economy. The economic condition of the country is at best kind of a mixed bag at the moment, despite what we keep hearing from the president and other people in Washington. There's a great deal of economic inequality in the country. I know, since I am almost exactly the same age you are, interestingly, I look at my investment money every once in a while, trying not to do it too often because it's so disheartening. And, you know, one day I'm rich, the next day I'm broke. Things have been a little unstable. What's your vision for the economy and for changing it?
So this gets a little tricky, but I'm convinced that in every economy that human beings have built over the ages, It's always a phenomenon that those who are a little bit wealthy or a little bit more advantaged at any particular point can become more wealthy, more powerful at a quicker rate than those who are not. So that causes a multiplier effect. So it ends up resulting in the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And when that happens, like in our economy over the last few decades, we see an ever-increasing concentration of wealth and power in the hands of fewer and fewer families in the United States. And where is the distribution coming from? It's coming from the lowest ranks, the least economically advantaged parts of our community. The 90 to the 99 percentiles has been left a little bit alone, but the middle class, you know, has had a tendency to see its buying power and its security of wealth dwindling away, and it gets concentrated into fewer hands in the great, you know, that 0.1% percentile of our population. That all being said, where is it going to end? It could just go on, and eventually you have very, very powerful individuals who have all the voice in our community. And that's the greatest risk we have towards our democracy, because our democracy is based on a notion of egalitarian equality, that everyone has a voice and that voice needs to be heard. And we all vote to make choices for our community. But if we have fewer and fewer people with bigger and bigger megaphones and able to manage and to manipulate the public conversation, then our democracy, it gets undermined, and we can end up with an oligarchy, as we see, for example, in other countries like Russia has an oligarchy where the control rests in a few hands around President Putin. So that's our risk. And we as self-governing people can make a choice. And the way we can do that is to put a tendency to counterbalance that automatic mechanism of concentrating wealth in fewer and fewer hands. And you do this like a lot of European countries do, by things like progressive taxation. We could have a much more robust, for example, inheritance tax in order to decrease the likelihood of building family dynasties. And, you know, some politicians talk about wealth tax, more reasonable capital gains taxation, perhaps progressive there as well. These things can be implemented, and they're not being implemented for the sake of we need the money in order to do programs. We really do need to do these things because we need to balance off this tendency of the concentration of power. And unless we do, we end up in a point where you can leave open the possibility for a revolution that in the course of human history has many times been violent. I'm not saying that's what we're headed for right now, but I only illustrate what happens in human history and the necessity of us making good choices right now to make a better promise for the future of those who will follow us.
We're running towards the end of our time together, and so I think I'm going to ask you what is probably the scariest question in your campaign. You're running in this primary against someone who has been in office for a good long time, seems to have a very reliable amount of support as, you know, a slightly more moderate Democrat than some. And he has, not to put too fine of a point on it, raised approximately 50 times as much money in this campaign as you have, which, you know, we all like to believe money doesn't matter, but we all know that at some level it does. So how would your presence in Congress be different than your opponents? And why should people vote for you?
I wish that it was only 50 times as much, to tell you the truth. But no.
Well, the last time I looked at the numbers, that was about right. What was it? That's probably old.
Yeah. Congressman Kind is very adapted, in my appreciation, to the system that we see at play in Washington, D.C. He's very good at being a member of that system. We have in our political system, our function, the crazy campaign financing system that allows people with a lot of wealth and power to have an overload of influence through campaign financing. And then we run campaigns that are not so much interviews to help people learn about candidates, but have become more like marketing wars or social engineering wars. Who can use the most resources to convince people to vote for something that they really haven't had much chance to get very honestly informed about? And so with that kind of system, a lot of money does help you to get reelected. But I offer an alternative. And I believe that when you enter a campaign, it is a public good, because we need to have a conversation about what kind of leadership we want to have. And people who make those choices, when they hire their representative, they need to know who these people are that they're considering to hire. And so it has to be a much more open opportunity for conversation and exchange of ideas like we're doing today, and not so much just a high-powered, expensive marketing battle of one team against the other. So I have no intention and never will participate in that activity of taking money from, for example, political action committees and large corporations. I certainly will always strive to rely upon just the common person to make an offering, to make a little sacrifice for the sake of their democracy. And I think the best solution would to have publicly financed campaigning, so that a candidate who is eligible and viable, a reasonable candidate by whatever choice means we have to make, then becomes eligible for public financing, because it is a public good to run honest, open conversation between candidates so that we can support our exercise of our democratic right and duty of choosing those people who we believe will listen to them carefully and take their values and their beliefs into the sausage factory, as somebody says, where we establish policy to reflect those values.
Okay, I would like to give our viewers out there in live streaming land one last chance to ask questions. I haven't seen any so far. And since that isn't happening, is there anything else you want to tell our viewers today?
Well, I guess I have to make the requisite suggestion that someone can go to the campaign website. And we have an events page, which doesn't have many events because, it's kind of hard to do those things in COVID season. But if you would go there, we would like to invite you to have an opportunity to receive a telephone call from me, if that's your desire, to learn more about my campaign and about me, or to set up a Zoom meeting for yourself and for your friends and family, or a FaceTime, whatever form of communication would appeal to you, so that I can participate in what I just described, that opportunity of allowing the electorate to get to know. I can't go door to door. I can't meet 750,000 people in this district, but I would certainly like to allow people to have free access to me as a candidate in order to learn more about what I hope and dream to be able to do if elected. So the campaign website is www.mynamemarkneumanforcongress.com. It's all one word, no, and it's Neumann, of course, is the German spelling, N-E-U-M-A-N-N. I think that does it, Steve.
Okay, there are some links to those resources on the website with the video, if people want to go look at WIS Community for that. But all that being said, I would really like to thank you for your time today, and I wish you all the best, Dr. Neumann.
Thank you, Steve, and I appreciate all the work you do in the media and trying to help people to have good conversation.
All right. Thank you very much, and we're just about right on time today.
Great.
We'll be bringing you more candidate interviews as the political season moves forward, and we hope to be bringing you also a couple of candidate forums. We'll see you soon.